I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In an effort to educate the youngest Kansas Cityans, KC's Mayor Sly James has proposed a new sales tax to help fund pre-K education programs. Today we'll go over this proposal and find out how it came to be. And we'll talk about the concerns some people have about the collection of funds and where they'll be going. Then, meet the violin virtuoso who suffered severe burns in an accidental fire and was told he would never play his instrument again. But this weekend, he'll be standing in front of a Kansas City symphony. Finally, Brian McTavish gives us his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Mayor Sly James is proposing a plan to increase the sales tax by 0.3% to fund early childhood education in Kansas City. The plan has just been announced. Some details of exactly what the mayor wants to do are not yet available. The idea is to make affordable early childhood education more accessible for eligible four-year-olds in Kansas City. In Kansas City, demand far outpaces the supply of pre-K slots. The plan would raise $30 million a year, and other cities around the country, including Denver, have launched similar plans. We're looking for your thoughts on this idea. Give us a shout, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Good idea, or do you want more details? Where do you fall down on it? 816-235-2888. With us now to give us their reaction to the plan are Seth Hunter. He's executive director of CCO, or Communities Creating Opportunity, that advocates for low-income people on both sides of the state line. The group was involved with an exploratory trip to Denver a few years ago to check out the pre-K program there. Seth, welcome. Nice to have you.
Yeah, really glad to be here.
Quinton Lucas is also joining us by phone. He represents the 3rd District at Large on the Kansas City, Missouri City Council. He joins us by phone. Councilman, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Councilman Lucas, what was your first reaction to this proposal from the mayor?
You know, I think the first thought was that we could use a little more collaboration on how we're working on it with City Council. I don't think almost any of my colleagues have been parties to these conversations, and so we would like to see how we're evaluating it there. One other point, of course, would be that there are a lot of priorities, from housing to the fact that evictions are an issue, so perhaps how this fits in with all of the work we're doing, and this is a responsible use of taxpayer dollars, I think could be helpful for us.
Why didn't the mayor brief the City Council before this thing came public?
You know, that I can't find an answer
probably
to.
Probably have to ask the mayor, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I think we've been willing, certainly, as a council, to look at tax increases where responsible. I do know that the mayor's been talking about this for a number of years, education more broadly. But the way I started learning about it was kind of through rumors, and folks were saying the chamber and the mayor were working on something. And I hope at least as the months go ahead, we can all have a full conversation about it for the best interest of our taxpayers. And what I really hope we don't get, Steve, is some sort of referendum approach to try to get it on the ballot, as opposed to having actually real hearings at City Council.
Seth, tell us about your organization's role in the planning process for this proposal. Were you guys involved?
Yeah, so as an organization, we've been on this issue for a number of years. We recognize the importance of what it means to provide certainly the most vulnerable folks in our city the best start possible. You know, we've had a consistent focus on poverty in Kansas City and really understanding what does life look like for people who are poor, right? So we talk about crime, we talk about unemployment, we talk about all those factors, but at their nexus, at their center, is not having the best start in life. So some of these kind of social conditions that we look at later in life and look at with great scorn and concern are as a direct result of some of these young people not having the best start in life. So this has been an issue that certainly we've cared about for a number of years. As you shared, we've been a part of other delegations traveling to other cities. We've hosted national leaders right here in Kansas City.
And you're on board, it sounds like.
I think we're really open to a solution that actually that is accessible, that is affordable, that provides high quality, and that is equitable to the folks who need it most.
Yeah, this idea is to get on the November ballot. Is that your understanding, Seth?
I think I've heard a number of different positions, but I do think the November ballot would be a great time for Kansas City to consider this issue.
Councilman, you know, test scores have been a challenge in Kansas City for years, and they've stopped Kansas City from regaining full accreditation from the state. The school district, in turn, has been a major drag on the community, you know, for a while now because of its reputation as underperforming. So given that, why isn't this exactly the right way to go here?
You know, I think there are a number of different questions. So first I would say, you know, I'm not really sure about the full contours of the proposal. All I know is that we're looking at $30 million for some number of years and just throwing lots of money into education without understanding the bureaucracy, et cetera, can be a challenge. And look no further than the desegregation era as your example, where we put lots of money into it without perhaps some clear guidance as to what we were doing exactly. But I might quibble with this point. One is that we should talk to the school district about this, not necessarily just use public dollars to enhance private educational opportunities throughout the city that might either be competitors or might be substitutes for the school district in this situation. I really do think that collaboration is key here, and this may be helpful. This may be great. This may be something the school district supports, but frankly, I think they should be consulted with. And frankly, I think all the other school districts in our city deserve that too. We've got 14 of them. I see no reason why we can't have that community conversation as opposed to rushing to put something on the ballot and really just kind of doing something without doing some of the work that I think Kansas City deserves.
Seth Hunter, again, with Communities Creating Opportunity. Why is the city even talking about this? I mean, don't most states fund pre-K education? Isn't that where the funding tends to come from?
Yes, but not at the level that is necessary to provide high-quality programs. When you look at the rate of reimbursement from the state, it is incredibly marginal. So when you think about, like, small providers, for example, the mom-and-pop providers that exist all across the city, the reimbursement they get from the state is not adequate to offer even the very basic of operations, much less to offer the kind of high quality programs that we know are necessary to really equip the very young and the very, very vulnerable in our city.
There's two problems here. Not enough kids can take part. And then secondly, the quality of the programs offered are somewhat suspect.
Can't offer the kind of the quality that's necessary with the funds that come from the state. We do need to look at other sources of funds. Now, on the funding sources, I think part of the challenge that we see, you know, we'll hear folks say, well, why can't you just use philanthropy? Well, that might be great for a season, but it's not enough to actually build a quality program over time. We have to address sustainability of funding. And while, you know, we definitely need philanthropy, we definitely need the kind of generosity of organizations and institutions in Kansas City and across the region, but we do need to get to a very stable funding source in order to ensure that the kind of predictability and balance is there to offer offer the kind of consistent quality over time.
That's where the 3-8 cent sales tax
that
comes
is exactly
from.
It.
Yeah. Let's go to some calls at 816-235-2888. As we bat around here, the mayor's proposal for a 3-8 cent sales tax for preschool education in Kansas City. Dolores from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Hello. I have two concerns. Number one, a sales tax is a regressive tax. And the second one is the oversight and accountability of the preschool programs that would be receiving this.
Mm-hmm. Dolores, if we don't do it via the sales tax, where would you recommend that we do it?
I think it should be like public schools are funded now through levies and so forth.
Property taxes, you're saying?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Seth, how can you represent poor folks? Mm-hmm. The sales tax is seen as regressive mm-hmm. and hits the poorest among us the hardest. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about a 3-8 cents sales tax increase?
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I mean, that is something that we always have to struggle with. And I think in this conversation, we absolutely have to struggle with this as well. I think the point is well stated. It is in fact regressive. And I think more than the funding source, the specific funding source, whether it be a sales tax versus a levy, I think we're really more committed to the outcomes and the issues, right? So we would be open to having having a conversation around if there are other viable sources of funds that can actually provide the necessary resources and is sustainable over time. I think we'd be open to that. Now, I can't say that while I recognize that the sales tax can be somewhat regressive, I think if we're looking at, for example, setting eligibility limits as it relates to income, right? So if we say that there's a cutoff, for folks at certain income levels, I think that could actually help to make the program less regressive.
Councilman Quentin Lucas, what are your concerns or what are your thoughts about the 38 cents sales tax idea? Is that going to fly with the community or what do you think?
You know, we have a community that's been very supportive in a number of different ways, but I do want to make sure that this doesn't become kind of like that translational medicine tax conversation we had a few years back, which was another attempted sales tax that had a meritorious kind of purpose to it. But again, I think people were asking, is this the best way to fund this sort of issue? Frankly, I'm sympathetic to the caller's point, which is to suggest that perhaps a property-based tax, first of all, does avoid the regressive nature of it. And then she makes another point, which is, you know, how do we set up kind of the bureaucracy, the standards, et cetera, of this program? But I think it's very fair to note right now, and I hear this in my district all the time, which is the poorest in the city, which is we're paying a lot of taxes. When you add water rates with sales taxes, with other property tax increases we've improved in Kansas City, I think it's worthwhile to come up with a real balance of how we do this properly.
Isn't one concern, Quentin, political in the sense that a property tax typically isn't very popular, struggles to pass at the polls, and maybe that's why we've gone back to the sales tax over and over and over again in this community?
You know, I think that's absolutely the case, which is troubling in my view, of course. But, right, we see that property taxes, people have real questions. There's a real concrete amount that you can kind of factor out over a number of years, whereas it's easy to say 1/8 cent or 3/8 of a cent, et cetera. But we're really getting to the point where folks who are doing regular purchasing in Kansas City, Missouri, really are funding this a lot. And I may just differ a bit with Dr. Hunter, although I certainly respect him greatly. And I would say that, you know, kind of how we fund it and how we tax people is key to the policy conversation. I mean, we all recognize that we want to support early childhood education. I hope we all recognize we want to support housing. There are a number of issues. But how we're doing it to make sure it's not a cost on the backs of a lot of our poorest people in Kansas City, I think is going to be key.
Yeah, and I do think we have to have a conversation as what has been the real cost, right? And when we're having a conversation about cost, I think we also have to look at what has been the cost over generations for inaction. When, you know, if we rewind back to 30 or 40 years, folks would say the very same things that they're saying now, which, you know, Kansas City, we need to move forward opportunities that ensures that we are providing quality programs at the developmental level where it can actually make a difference. And I think we have to dispense with perfection this time to say that, you know, the inaction that we've seen on this issue has led to a set of disastrous consequences that we immediately need to address as a community. And I think we have to start from the place of saying, are we truly committed to this issue? And if so, perfection this time is going to be the cost of not doing anything.
You know, Seth Dolores, our caller, also had a question about oversight of this program. Do we know enough yet about how the program would work that you can respond to that?
Yeah, and I think there are a number of folks who are committed to this issue who also bring technical expertise. They're educators, they're pediatricians, they're, you know, curricular folks that we can draw from all across the city. And I think there's a broad depth of expertise that can be leveraged to provide adequate oversight to this. So I think as it relates to that particular piece, I think there's a real strength, there's a real deep bench in Kansas City of folks who are committed with sufficient qualifications to help us provide sufficient oversight to a program.
Councilman Lucas, is there any question in your mind about the general overall effectiveness of pre-K education? I mean, it has this, I think it's fair to say, it has this sterling reputation with most people that it's the answer. And I'm wondering, is pre-K education all that it's cracked up to be?
You know, I would say that it is. And this has actually been an interesting conversation because my family, my sisters, went to Operation Breakthrough, what would have been 35 years ago.
You're dating yourself, Quentin.
I know, finally. And it does have some real, I think, positive impact. I think when we're talking about a conversation, what we need to do is actually make sure we're having a broad one about how can we support it citywide? How can we support it with the help of our local school districts? How can we make sure that this is kind of a broad public answer to the issue. And so I think this is something we need to keep pushing, not just locally, but in the state of Missouri and hopefully Kansas as well. But I believe that identifying how to do it right is going to be key. I mean, I use the desegregation example for a reason. That was a situation where we really did identify funding sources greatly, and you don't necessarily always see that work. And so what you need to make sure you're doing here is in that conversation, try to get public buy-in, try to really sell why this is important and how we can make a difference long term.
We're talking about Mayor James's proposal for a 38-cent sales tax to fund pre-K education in Kansas City. Our number here again, 816-235-2888 for your first reactions to this proposal that's just been brought forth, at least in the public arena, in just recent days. Seth Hunter, I'm wondering if pre-K is the answer or a partial answer here. I was struck by this finding that was written about in the Star about the 2015 trip to Denver when city leaders here went out to Denver to check out the pre-K program there. The Star wrote this: while data shows that graduates who came through the preschool program were outperforming those who didn't, on third grade tests, elementary schools aren't narrowing achievement gaps between advantaged and disadvantaged students. That suggests that maybe preschool education is no panacea here. It helps with kids who take part, but not the overall situation.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, this is an issue that if you talk to the experts, we know a lot about, you know, we know a tremendous amount about what happens when we provide these development opportunities. And I think we have to look at the outcomes beyond just test scores, right? I think that is actually one kind of metric to determine the benefits of high quality early childhood experiences. And I think that's only one. I think we have to also look at what are some of the other kind of societal benefits that happen over time. You know, we talk about, for example, that, you know, folks look at the third grade reading level and determine whether or not, you know, the number of jails that are needed, right, in the future. And I think, you know, so we know tremendous about what happens at that early period in life between ages 2, 3, and 4, right? And creating these opportunities, yes, it helps to contribute to higher academic performance, but I think there are a number of other kind of social emotional indicators that also has to be considered within our evaluation matrix of how we determine the benefits of these programs.
All right. You know, Councilman Lucas, we talked a few minutes ago about this notion that the council wasn't informed about this program before it came public. How about the lack of communication with school superintendents? Apparently, they weren't informed either. How big of a concern is that to you, Councilman?
You know, it's a significant one for me. I mean, I guess council will get over it. That's the rules of politics, et cetera. But I do think when we have people that are deputized to work on education, spend their days, their months, their professional careers trying to address issues like Superintendent Bedell and the Kansas City School District have done on early childhood education in particular, you would hope that there is some sort of collaborative conversation relating to that. And frankly, I think they can be, in many ways, experts as well, and many of them have experts in how you address this early childhood education issue in Kansas City. So I would hope this gives us all an opportunity to say, let's sit down, talk with each other, thinking about the positives of early childhood education, the tax burden issue, and frankly, come to a holistic solution rather than one that seems to be one that's kind of just pushed by some experts right now, but perhaps without full community involvement.
Lots of people want to talk about this. We just have a few minutes left. Kevin from Brookside area, good morning.
Hi there, good morning. The mayor asked us to vote for higher prices for us for flights in and out of Kansas City. We gave that to him. We just passed a tax increase for ourselves, and now this is at least the third that I'm aware of where he's asking us for tax increases, and that's all well and good, but maybe if we stopped handing out tax benefits for the already wealthy and corporations in the form of TIFs and any other thing, maybe we wouldn't need these.
Okay. Any thoughts there, Seth?
I mean, I think it brings up a really good point around how do we look at balancing economic development while also doing it in a way that's equitable. And I got to tell you, I mean, I think that is an issue that, you know, really hits to the heart of the people who we organize in Kansas City. And that tends to be the folks who are poor. And those individuals probably would share in Kevin's sentiments around, you know, we see some of these benefits and rarely do they, or not often enough, do they reach the communities where the folks who have been waiting for opportunity get to see them and get to experience them. So I do share your concern there. Now, while I recognize that that exists as a system, and I think we have to look at how do we perfect that, how do we make the TIF system more equitable, because I think it can be a lot more equitable. I also have to challenge us to think about what is our commitment to children and families in our city, right? And I don't think we want to create a false choice where we have to reform all these other broken systems and programs before we come around to really thinking about children and families. And I don't think Kevin is saying that, right?
Right.
But I do think as a community, we have to wrestle with that. And I think we have the opportunity in this moment to act in ways that we have not acted before. We've talked about this issue. We've agreed around it, about its importance, but generations continue to be failed by not having these opportunities. And I think we want to make this time different.
Councilman Lucas, I've also heard a little bit of chatter that this idea of subsidizing preschool amounts to something of a voucher system. What would you say to those who say this is just another way of dressing up a voucher program?
You know, I will say at first blush, and I have more to review, but I think that's absolutely a fair criticism. I mean, at least from what I know, and frankly, that was just reading in many ways the newspaper story, it seemed as if we're creating this perhaps voucher system that can go to fund private institutions, other daycares, et cetera. For example, I graduated from high school to Barstow School, private school in Kansas City, has a preschool and pre-K kind of branch. Should people who are sending their children there have the ability to access these public dollars that support it? Or should we actually have public schools that are able to support these sorts of things? I mean, frankly, it does introduce, I think, that voucher conversation just with a much younger type of student.
How should the program be structured to get away from that? Do you have any ideas on that front?
You know, Seth actually brought up an interesting point, which is perhaps some income-based restriction. But then, of course, one wonders if that works, how do you set that? I mean, what we're seeing is that there needs to be much greater conversation on it. And frankly, I think that has to be one that is trying to enhance what our public schools are offering now throughout Kansas City, Missouri. It's not just a Kansas City public schools conversation. It's all the districts that are involved. And I think that's the real way you address it in creating more opportunities for early childhood learning.
Let's go to Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. Richard, you're on Up to Date. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm opposed to the sales tax because we have a property tax in place now to support schools, and I'm in favor of all kinds of education, the more the better. I used to be a trustee with the community colleges, so I'm in favor of education. But the city is busy destroying our tax base that generates money for the schools. An example is that big hotel that was blown up last week. They should have sold that to somebody, auctioned it off. That way the property would still be on the tax rolls, and we'd still be collecting real estate taxes from somebody. If they had enough money to buy the building, they could probably pay their taxes every year.
All right, Richard, I appreciate the phone call. Thank you. Thomas from Midtown. Thomas, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the preschool funding proposal. Good morning.
Hey, Steve, how's it going?
Well, thanks.
Quick question for you or anyone else on the line, if there has been any sort of conversation about a kind of cost savings measure. I've heard of it in Scandinavia. I think it's kind of a new thing there, but it seems to be working. It's combining pre-K, early childhood education and care with elderly care as a kind of cost savings measure, and just kind of tying the whole thing together and saving a bit of money through that.
Well, when it comes to forward-thinking proposals, that's why we bring Councilman Quentin Lucas into the conversation. What do you make of it, Councilman?
You know, I think that is fascinating. I don't know enough about the Scandinavian plan. I do find it interesting. I will say this, though, to the gentleman's point. Well, Steve, there's another talk right now about a senior citizens kind of sales tax being floated out of Jackson County to help pay for senior services as well,
right,
which again is a laudatory issue, laudatory goal, but kind of does speak to this idea of maybe we all need to sit down and kind of think about how can we use tax dollars that are already coming in to make sure that we're adequately applying them in the different areas, as opposed to a hodgepodge of tax increases that are really hitting the same people repeatedly, particularly this heavy use of sales taxes.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. The vote on this proposal looks like it'll be in November. That was Councilman Quentin Lucas of Kansas City's 3rd District. Quentin, always a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Seth Hunter was also with us. He's executive director of CCO, or Communities Creating Opportunity. Seth, always good to have you, too.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll meet the violinist who survived and soared, even though at age 15, he was badly burned. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, tune in for our third conversation with Kansas's gubernatorial candidates. We'll meet the state's insurance commissioner. That's Republican Ken Selzer. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, becoming a star in the world of classical music is tough enough, but when progress toward that goal is thwarted by a terrible accident, the path forward is all the tougher. Augustine Hadalek has persevered. At 15, he was badly burned when tractor fuel caught fire on his family's vineyard in Italy. Some doctors told him he'd never play again, but today he's hailed as one of the most distinctive violinists of his generation. The New York Times has said of him that he plays with dazzling technique, a gorgeous tone, and penetrating, spontaneous musicality. Augustine Hadalek performs this weekend with the Kansas City Symphony, and this is what he sounds like. Augustine Hadalek joins me now, and welcome.
Hello. Hi.
That's just amazing.
Oh.
You know, it sounds like the accident isn't holding you back any longer. You've overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right?
It was a very long time ago.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You were 15 at the time that happened to you. You've been performing since you were age 7. How big a blow was it to you?
Well, it was definitely a major setback. But
yeah.
But it was like 19 years ago, so I don't really think about it anymore.
Yeah. What was it about music that made you so determined to stay with it, even from the time you were a little child?
Well, when I grew up, I have two older brothers, and they were also playing music. One of them was playing the cello. The other one was playing the piano.
Your father played?
And my father played the cello as well. And so I was hearing these sounds from a very early age. And when I was 5, I wanted to play music as well. But really already in the years prior, I was listening. And and so my parents got me a violin. And I didn't really know what I was getting into. And the violin is probably the instrument that sounds the worst when you first started. So it's not really fun to listen to someone start on the violin.
Squeaking and squawking and everything else.
It's pretty rough. But I kept trying, and I became very inspired when I first heard great violinists play, and I realized how beautiful it can sound, that it's very much like a human voice. The sound of the violin can sound very lyrical. And now I'm here. I don't know. I don't really remember the time before I played.
Yeah. I mean, but it's one thing for a little kid to hear something like that and think, boy, that sounds great. And something else entirely for a youngster to stay with it year after year after year. What drove you?
Well, you know, practicing isn't very much fun. So,
no.
And it's still not fun for me now. It was never fun for me, really. But there were times that when I was motivated and inspired because I'd heard a great musician play, or because I was had some kind of breakthrough, was making some kind of progress with my playing, when you feel like you're on a roll and you don't mind spending hours and hours a day playing because things are improving and you're enjoying playing the instrument. So definitely that's something that can happen, that often the hardest thing with practicing is taking the instrument out of the case the first, you know, at the beginning of the day.
That's good point.
But I kind of dread. Once I'm playing, I kind of get into it. And well, and the other thing is that I really enjoy the rehearsals and concerts that I do and playing with other people. And mm-hmm. I actually think the best thing maybe about being a violinist is that this is an instrument that you don't play by yourself usually. Mm-hmm. And most of the music written for the violin is with other people, with piano, with other string players or with orchestra. And so everywhere I go, I collaborate with other musicians, and it's a very social activity. And
is that what keeps you going at this point in your career? I mean, this notion that you've got a concert coming up this weekend in Kansas City, so by George, you better be ready for it because you've been doing this for so many years now.
Well, it's a little bit of pressure can really help get you going. But it's every time I'm on stage, I know why I do what I do and that it's worth all the effort. I would say that the most annoying part of what I do is probably actually the traveling.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of traveling and, you know, as everybody knows who travels a lot, you know, often flights get canceled or you get, you know, things can be, especially in the winter when there's snowstorms. I had some tough travel days this season, but yeah. That's getting much better now that we're in the summer. And I'm really excited to be back here in Kansas City playing with the Kansas City Symphony and Michael Stern.
Augustine performs Friday through Sunday with the Kansas City Symphony, led by Michael Stern at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. More information, kcsymphony.org. You know, when people hear you play, it's so remarkable. And if you go and check out some of your videos online, they are equally remarkable. What can't you do yet that you still need to conquer on the fiddle? What's missing from the great repertoire here?
I don't know.
Is there something you're still sort of you're reaching for, or at this point, is that all past you now?
Well, there are a lot of great music. There's a lot of great music written for the violin. So there's always more to discover also when it comes to contemporary music and pieces that are written right now. So I don't think I'll stop learning new pieces.
Right.
But I have at this point performed most of the famous violin repertoire, and I also love going back to those pieces and revisiting them. And the greatest pieces they never become boring, even if I play them 1,000 times.
Really?
It's still very enjoyable because the music is just that beautiful. And but actually, this weekend I'm playing a pretty unusual repertoire.
Thomas Addis is one of your favorite composers, a more contemporary composer.
Yes, he wrote a violin concerto in 2005. He's a British composer. He's very very famous in England, and this is, I think, it's an extraordinary piece and one of the best contemporary violin works. I don't know how to describe. Let's do this.
Let's play a little bit of it, okay? We have a piece here of you playing the first part of Thomas Addis's Concentric Paths Rings, okay?
Okay, sure.
Let's listen. It's interesting to me, that's one of the few classical pieces I've ever heard where the title of it, Concentric Paths Rings, fit what we just heard there.
Uh-huh.
You know, what draws you to him? What's the big attraction to you and Thomas Addis?
Well, in the piece you just heard, which is the first movement of Concentric Paths, it's very, I would say it's very much like a kaleidoscope.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, well, each of these three movements explores a different way that of somehow making writing music that sounds circular. So mm-hmm. in this case, these rings that it's something, yes. the music just keeps spinning around in a kind of maybe kind of minimalist way. And the second movement is my favorite movement. It's very, very, very dramatic and I would say tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And the rings in this case, or not the rings, the circles, the concentric paths or whatever, the fact that it's a passacaglia, which is a Baroque concept, and Bach wrote a lot of passacaglias where a bass line just, you know, of eight bars repeats over and over.
Well, what do you like about it? What draws mm-hmm. you to it?
Well, the second movement is very, very emotional and tragic and poignant, and there are moments that are just so... so beautiful when the mm-hmm. texture clears and very, very pure. And
you know, a lot of folks out there, this contemporary stuff, they sort of rear back from it a little bit. They don't embrace it. You're also going to be performing Haydn this weekend,
yes.
a more classical, traditional. But what do you say to folks who maybe keep the more contemporary composers at arm's length?
You know, there are things in this piece that you will like the first time you listen to, but then there are also some things that will make more sense maybe the second or third time that you hear them. And when you are hearing Haydn or Mozart, you're drawing on a lot of memories of other music you've heard.
That's
so it's
right.
very easy to understand. Sometimes it can just take a little moment to get into the world of another composer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I'm very sure that in this piece, there are moments, especially in the second movement, that will touch even somebody who hears it the very first time.
You know, that's one of the amazing things about music to me, any kind of music, that what is it about a song that you hear it the first time and the second time, it doesn't really connect with you, but suddenly on the third or fourth or fifth listen, something happens inside your noggin and you just suddenly fall in love with the piece and you can't stop playing it. It's like, what is that about? You ever figured it out?
Yeah, I think it has to do with recognizing music again that you've heard. And some composers are very practical. You know, when you look at somebody like Beethoven, he's very, very smart about repeating some of his best ideas a lot.
Yes.
So that by the time you're done listening to it the first time, you know it because you've heard certain ideas so many times. So he's very, very smart at somehow taking you by the hand and getting you there.
Yeah.
But you know, there are the third movement of the Addis concerto is a dance, and it sounds a little bit like cavemen dancing around a fire maybe or something like that. And inevitably whenever we rehearse it when there's the intermission, you know, in the rehearsal and the musicians all get up, everyone's whistling the steam and somehow can't get it out of the head. So it has a little bit of that. I think this piece has some of those qualities
yeah.
that, for example, Beethoven's music has, that you hear it and then it's stuck in your head and you just keep thinking about it.
You know, before you go, Augustine, what makes Michael Stern, what's different about Michael Stern? What's unique about Michael Stern as a conductor compared to others you've worked with? What sets him apart?
Well, I think he's a wonderful musician.
Yeah.
And really fun to work with. He's incredibly funny also. I don't know
yeah.
if he was here.
He's been here any number of times. Yeah.
So as you know, he's, everyone cracks up a lot in rehearsal because he's very, very funny.
That's a good thing, and, I assume.
And yeah. a lovely person to work with. And of course, you know, when I collaborate on a concerto, it'll be a very different experience depending on who I'm playing with. And mm-hmm. when you play with somebody who's very generous and warm and somehow feels like they you know, he supports me, and then a lovely experience.
Well, let's go out with Augustine Hadelijk playing a little Haydn, which again he'll be playing this weekend. And just a reminder, he'll be performing Friday through Sunday with the Kansas City Symphony at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. More information at kcsymphony.org. Augustine, what a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Love
your
music. All the best to you.
All right. Thank you.
Find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow KCUR on Facebook. And tomorrow, the Cinephiles take a look back to 1968 and find out what made it such a remarkable year in film. Up to Date is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.